there's no such thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Mike Levin, founder of Jewish Future Promise, an organization that encourages individuals and couples to make a moral commitment to allocate at least 50% of their estates, whatever the size, to Jewish causes or the State of Israel. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We are now in the midst of the final Jewish month of the 5785 year, called Elul on the Hebrew calendar, and I've been thinking about the great theme of this season, the concept of tshuva. Tshuva is usually translated as repentance, but it really means return. Return to being the best person that you can be. Return to your ideal version of yourself. Return, frankly, to being genuinely good when you probably haven't been able to be that consistently over the past 12 months. Which means, if you think about it at all and have ability for serious introspection, you must change. We'll be exploring Kabbalistic mystical approaches to change at our Slichot Gateway to the High Holy Days at Beit Simcha this coming Saturday night at 8 p.m., It's called, What Does It Take to Change? Change. You know, it's interesting. The Hebrew word for year, shana, essentially means change. Lishnot, literally, is to change. A new year is thus automatically a time when we have the opportunity to change, hopefully for the better. So, what does it take to change? Well, change is always challenging, even when it's for good. Generally speaking, it's easier to do the same things over again the same way we've done them. We already know how to do what we've done, and even if the results aren't fulfilling or meaningful, they are predictable. That's why so many of us find it nearly impossible to make significant changes in our personal lives and conduct. We somehow think that if we just keep doing what we've been doing and failing, we eventually will succeed. In response, the great Jewish physicist Albert Einstein defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And isn't that what most of us choose to do in our own lives? As we move into the home stretch of this 5785 year on the Jewish calendar, the danger is that we'll continue to do what we've always done and arrive next year at Rosh Hashanah to discover we've made the same mistakes and failed to improve our lives yet again. Well, if that proves to be the case, we'll have wasted the opportunity to make things better, holier, more meaningful. We will have failed in our essential purpose in life. This very special time of year gives us a chance to choose to live a better life, to live more sacred, more valuable lives generally. What we must do is look in the mirror honestly and see reflected there somebody who has the capacity to become more than she or he was over the last 12 months. That someone in the mirror, of course, is you. You are the one who can act to make this happen. Okay, so how do we start? The first step is to apologize to anybody you've offended or hurt this past year. Try starting today. Call someone you should have called recently, somebody you ignored when they needed you. Find a person that you wronged and try to make it up to them. Reach out and do something caring for someone who can't benefit you. It's all part of the process of tshuva in Judaism, of return and repair. That's a great process, if sometimes a challenging one. Properly done, it can lead to real growth and return. And it is the best and sometimes only way to make our lives better in this coming Jewish year. And so to play us in this morning for Rosh Hashanah, which is coming up just 2 weeks from tomorrow night, Monday evening, September 22nd, here's a text used for Slichot, the late night study session and service, the gateway to the High Holy Days. Haneshama lach, v'haguf shelach. The soul is yours, God, and the body, too, is yours. Slichot is this Saturday night, September 13th, 8 p.m. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha. That was Hanashamalach for the coming High Holy Days, 2 weeks away now. You can join us for High Holy Days services at Beit Simcha, both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur this year. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to register. We'd love to have you join us. When we come back in a moment on To Jewish, our guest this morning, Mike Levin, founder of Jewish Future Promise, we'll explain why it's such an important concept, this future promise, and just what a moral commitment to the Jewish people and the Jewish future can mean in your life. Find out when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people, an individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort? As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning. Mike Levin is the creator, really, and head of Jewish Future Promise, a fascinating idea and concept that is more than that, a way for Jews to show their commitment to the Jewish people and the State of Israel through their own estates. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you, Rabbi. Nice to be here.
So tell us, where'd the idea for this come from?
Well, I watched the Buffett Promise for billionaires, and combine that with the worrying about the Jewish future. Many books have been written about Jewish philanthropy, a recent one by Wertheimer, I think.
Yeah, Jack Wertheimer.
All this kind of stuff that indicated that we're having some real problems and about the future as generations of assimilated Jews forget what their basic obligations are for the future of the Jewish people and Israel. And I started off by thinking about why not have a promise that said I will support whatever charitable stuff, assets I leave to charity, that 50% or more should be spent Jewishly. Some of that came from the fact that a lot of the big foundations were only spending 11% of their donations Jewishly, and a lot of the people were now spending in assimilated areas, not in Jewish causes. And a lack of new day schools, a lack of new Jewish camps, conflicts with Israel policies, things like that. So we started about 4.5 years ago with the promise, and to get signatures for commitment. And along the way, we've measured some of those. Also along the way, we started a different brand called the Jewish Youth Promise, which was for young people under 24 years old. And so we have two brands that we basically promote significantly through organizations for the youth and through social media for the adults. We do surveys. We're just about to launch another survey where we've gotten some statistics of the signatures. We've had significant growth in the last 3 years. It's accelerated, obviously, like a lot more Jewish awareness since October 7th and October 8th. And we have some data. Some of it satisfies me and some of it doesn't. So we're about to issue another survey in the next couple of months to retest what we've gotten. But we have some good numbers now. We're close to 129,000 individuals that have signed the Jewish Future Promise as adults, and about 35,000 youth that have signed the Youth Promise. The Youth Promise doesn't deal with wills, obviously. It deals just simply with a commitment to the Jewish future and to the Jewish people and to Israel. If you want some of the statistics we recently wrote about them, I can quote them to you if you wish.
Well, let's talk about that later in the show, and maybe we can also talk about some of the people who have made the promise and then how it all works. We'll talk much more with Mike Levin about Jewish Future Promise when we come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established 7 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services services or come on Facebook Live, go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going now for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us in our terrific Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. The High Holy Days are nearly upon us. It's exactly 2 weeks from tomorrow night, the evening of September 22nd, Rosh Hashanah evening services are at 6:30 p.m. Rosh Hashanah morning services are at 9:30 a.m. on the 23rd. You can join us at Beit Simcha for our beautiful, meaningful, and inspiring Days of Awe services and events. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Guests are very welcome, but you must register in advance. All fees are applicable to membership if you choose to join. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come Friday night, 6:30 p.m. Shabbat services, always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat with homemade challah. 9 a.m. Torah study on Saturday morning, always followed at 10 a.m. by Shabbat morning services and a delicious Kiddush. Services are led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson, if you want to see our services or come to them virtually. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom, including our brand new Adult B'nai Mitzvah program that meets on Sunday afternoons. Find out about those on our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, the High Holy Days, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Slichot this coming Saturday night, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing congregation and Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, 2JewishRadio.com, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America. According to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments all help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520
888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We talked just a little bit last week, but I want to dig a little deeper. You know, we think about the major Jewish communities in the world, America, Israel, maybe not in that order anymore numerically. And then we'll talk about, you know, France or some of the other larger Jewish communities around the world. But in fact, probably the third largest Jewish community by population, maybe the third and fourth largest, are very likely Russia and Ukraine. Let's talk a little bit about what those communities consist of and what's happening there.
Right. I think you have the rank order right, exactly right. But the problem with counting Jews in places like Russia and Ukraine is, by what criteria is somebody Jewish? So if they're identified as Jews by their neighbors or by anti-Semites or neo-Nazis, the numbers are staggering in Russia and Ukraine. If the chief rabbi of Israel is the one doing the counting and people have to have two Jewish parents and all that, then the numbers are much, much smaller. So you get like these incredibly wide ranges that make it sound like it's just guesswork, but it's not. It's just a question of definition. And in both Russia and Ukraine, what you have today is young people, like high school kids, teenagers, young adults, who are not connected to any sense of community. There's certainly no more, you know, Komsomol or whatever. The things that existed in the old Soviet days to create a sense of community are gone. And people with any kind of Jewish heritage at all, including maybe one great-grandparent, are rediscovering their roots thanks to what is essentially missionary work done by every major movement of Judaism in this country, plus like the JBC and Chabad. And, I mean, everybody's out there recruiting souls. And those souls are attracted to warmth and ritual and a sense of continuity, even if there was a major discontinuity between 1917 and, let's say, the end of the 1900s.
Major discontinuity, I would say.
But it's not only the Shoah. It's also the fact that the Soviet Union was very much anti-religion, including their own religion. So the Russian Orthodox Church, to the extent to which some weakened, very much diminished form of it continued to exist, was a puppet of the state. And other religions were completely banned. So, you know, there was a time in my lifetime, because I remember doing this, when going to the former Soviet Union to distribute any form of like Jewish educational material, worship material, prayer books, Bibles, whatever, was punishable by death. And yet people went in from the outside at great personal risk and smuggled in these books and distributed them in Jewish community centers and shuls, which were often clandestine affairs in somebody's living room.
By the way, my parents went on exactly that kind of a mission in the 1970s. You know, my dad was a cantor and rabbi, and he went as a musician, and my mom went as a school teacher, and, you know, they smuggled in Siddurim and Talises and stuff. And it was all there. You know, the KGB bugged their room. They were followed. You had to be really careful.
Well, I'm not sure all your listeners know what Siddurim means.
Prayer books, Hebrew prayer books, and Hebrew, and actually, you know, Hebrew primers, like, you know, big books to teach people Hebrew.
Right. And by the 70s, it had already started loosening up. You know, by the end of the 70s, there was already the beginning of like perestroika and all that stuff.
So, right. No, this is before that, really, but yeah.
The really bad period was, let's say, a couple decades beyond the Shoah, from, let's say, 45 to 65 or even maybe 75. But by the end of the 70s, it started getting much looser, and maybe it was still illegal, but you weren't strip searched when you entered the country to see if you were like carrying a prayer book under your arm.
It's fascinating to see what's happening today all over these former Iron Curtain countries, and maybe we'll talk about that next week, Tom. Thanks so much.
I look forward to it.
Time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A priest and a rabbi sit next to each other on an airplane. After a while, the priest turns to the rabbi, nudges him, and says, "Is it still a requirement of your faith that you not eat pork?" The rabbi responds, yes, that's still one of our beliefs. The priest then asks, have you ever eaten pork? The rabbi sighs and replies, yes, one occasion I did succumb to temptation and I tasted a ham sandwich. The priest nods understandingly, goes on reading. A while later, the rabbi speaks up and nudges the priest. Father, is it still a requirement of your church that you must remain celibate? The priest replies, yes, that is very much still a part of our faith. The rabbi asks, Father, have you ever fallen to the temptations of the flesh? The priest replies, yes, Rabbi. On one occasion, I was weak and broke with my faith. The rabbi nods understandingly. He's silent for a while. Then he turns and says, sure beats a ham sandwich, doesn't it? That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Too Jewish, Just for You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the Torah portion of Ki Tavo in Deuteronomy, which begins with an unusual declaration. When we come into the land that the Lord our God will give us as an inheritance, we are to take the first fruits of our produce, bring these to the priest who is in the land then, and say this formula. Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering Aramean. He came to Egypt, few in number, became a great nation there. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and enslaved us, but God brought us out with a great hand and an outstretched arm, brought us to this place that flows with milk and honey. In addition to the central role in an important biblical ritual, by the way, this passage is quoted often in rabbinic literature, most famously in the Pesach Haggadah. But this sentence we are supposed to say when we bring our offering to the tabernacle in those days and later the temple is surprising. In its mini-history of our ancient people of Israel, it includes two of the greatest elements of our people's history, the exodus from Egypt and the entry into and settlement of the land of Israel. But curiously, it omits any mention of a third equally crucial event, the receiving of the Ten Commandments, the Torah at Sinai. This is a fascinating, even shocking omission. If the three most important elements of Jewish identity are God, Torah, and Israel, as Echad Ha'am taught us, omitting Torah means having an incomplete form of Judaism at best. Ironically, right here in the Torah, what is missing is Torah itself. The explanation for this omission teaches much about how religion evolves and what an organic and remarkable creation Judaism is. In biblical times, our people constituted an agricultural nation, living on and with the land. The most important religious experiences were farming-related, planting crops, harvesting, dividing the produce, offering it to God, and, you know, eating it. The connection to the land itself, the labor needed to produce food from it, was central to our identity. Absolutely central. Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, was truly the holy land of Israel. Our intimate and permanent relationship to that land was forged over many centuries of daily labor and life. When Zionism reconnected Jews to the land in the 19th century in a real, tangible, practical, agricultural way, it revived the whole experience of loving and serving God by creating food out of the very earth. Hamotzi lechem min haaretz, we say. The land of Israel was at the heart of our people then. It is also at the heart of Ki Tavo, as we hope it is at the heart of every Jew in the world. Like Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, God too was central to Jewish life in the times of the Bible as today. In Ki Tavo, we're commanded to bring this offering to God in the tabernacle, and of course later the temple, and to thank God for all that we have. And we are supposed to remember the great gift of freedom God conferred upon us by miraculously redeeming us from Egyptian slavery. Everything comes from God. A good lesson today as way back in the time of Deuteronomy. So here we have God and Israel, but still not Torah. Clearly, the third leg of this stool of Jewish identity was far less crucial to our ancestors in the time of Deuteronomy than the other two aspects were. But why? As farmers in our land, the need to study Torah in whatever form it existed must have seemed less than urgent. We had an immediate relationship with the land. We needed God for the basics that make agriculture possible: rain, sun, soil. The importance of Torah was diminished when we lived on the land itself. When we were in our own land 2,000 years ago, that land of Israel and our relationship to God were central. Torah, not so much. But when we were sent into exile in the diaspora and forcibly torn from our land, boy, we needed Torah. In fact, without the study of Torah, Judaism itself would have disappeared. The people of Israel faded into the dust of history. Only Torah preserved us, gave us the moral foundation and religious identity, not only to survive, but thrive. When we read in Ki Tavoh, right here in the Torah, of course, that we are to give a tenth of all we earn to charity, to the poor and the homeless, the widow and the orphan, we acknowledge that we have been blessed. We follow an ancient agricultural practice, perhaps more than 3,000 years old, designed for an ancient people in a land long ago, but we are using this remarkable text, the Torah, to teach us how we can live today. And therein lies the true genius of Judaism. For wherever we are in the world today, it is the Torah that binds us together, makes possible our unity as a people. It is the Torah that reminds us to worship God, reminds us of our connection to the land of Israel. It is the Torah that teaches us that tzedakah, charity, must be part and parcel of our very being. It is our remarkable ability to evolve our knowledge and understanding of Torah that have allowed us to reshape our fantastic religion to fit every era and every place on the whole of this globe. Paradoxically, even when the Torah seems absent, as it appears to be here in Ki Tavoh, it is not only implicitly present, but actually central in our religion and our lives. May it always be so for each of us. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest Mike Levin explains why it's important to have a Jewish future promise, what a difference it makes in the world for those who make it after they are gone. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Belgium has become the latest country in the world to announce plans to recognize Palestinian statehood at the UN General Assembly this month in New York. In an announcement last week, Deputy Prime Minister Maxime Prevot said the recognition was intended to increase pressure on the Israeli government and the Hamas terrorists, adding Israel has violated its international obligation to prevent any risk of genocide. Prevot stipulated the move will only become official once Hamas no longer has any role in managing Palestine and all Israeli hostages are released from Gaza. This is not about sanctioning the Israeli people, but ensuring that their government respects international and humanitarian law and takes action to try to change the situation on the ground, she said. Belgian Prime Minister Bart De Wever had previously joined German leaders, saying that recognizing a Palestinian state before Hamas removal would be pointless. But his government faced fierce pressure for further action from center and left-wing member parties. It was alleviated by this announcement. Prevot outlined 12 firm sanctions that will be implemented against Israel and Hamas, including bans on importing products from Israeli settlements and designating certain Israeli ministers, violent settlers, and Hamas leaders as persona non grata in Belgium. Belgium will also support the European Union suspending cooperation with Israel, including its trade pact known as the Association Agreement, as well as research programs and technical cooperation. The announcement makes Belgium the latest country to add to a growing list of support for Palestinian statehood at the UN General Assembly, following similar declarations from Australia, France, the United Kingdom, and Canada. Currently, more than 140 countries recognize Palestinian statehood, quite fascinating, making up three-quarters of UN members recognizing an imaginary state. Gerald Nadler, the New York congressman who once came armed with a Zabar's bag to a presidential impeachment hearing, will not run for re-election, he announced last week. The Jewish representative said he planned now to join the rapidly growing number of Democrats voting against the continued sale of offensive weapons to Israel, citing what he said were without question war crimes, quote-unquote, in Gaza. I don't know what to say at this point, Jerry Nadler, a longtime pro-Israel stalwart, added. I can't defend what Israel is doing. Nadler's retirement deprives Congress of its most senior Jewish member, the only one to have received an Orthodox Jewish education. And a Democratic National Committee panel blocked a resolution last week calling for the suspension of military aid to Israel and recognition of Palestinian statehood after a debate underscoring growing fissures within the party over its long-standing support of Israel. The resolution, proposed by Allison Minerly, a new Gen Z member from Florida, would have joined the growing chorus of calls in the House and Senate recently to block weapons sales to Israel. Following debate over the resolution at the DNC's summer meeting in Minneapolis, Minnesota last week, the resolution received a resolute block of nay votes from the panel. The committee unanimously passed a different resolution proposed by DNC Chairman Ken Martin, calling for the unrestricted flow of food and medical aid to Gaza, a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and a two-state solution negotiated through direct bilateral negotiations, God willing. One thing all of us agree on is that the crisis in Gaza is urgent, Martin said. This resolution is focused on the humanitarian crisis and makes clear that it must be addressed as the emergency that it is. Immediately after the resolution passed, however, Martin withdrew it, saying he will instead convene a task force to continue discussing Israel issues. The series of developments highlighted wide-ranging and changing perspectives on Israel within the Democratic Party and underscored that a more traditional outlook continues to prevail. Martin's resolution echoes long-standing positions on Israel held by the Democratic Party in its 2024 platform, affirming under former President Joe Biden that he had worked tirelessly to ensure the unimpeded delivery of humanitarian assistance to the Palestinian people. The debate over the two resolutions reflects a growing divide among Democrats over their stances on Israel. Support for the country's ongoing offensive in Gaza has sharply declined over the past year. A recent Gallup poll found that among Democratic voters, approval for Israel's war in Gaza had fallen from 36% in November 2023 to just 8% last month. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. Welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Mike Levin, is the creator of Jewish Future Promise. It's really quite a fascinating idea, a way to show your commitment to giving at least 50% of your estate to the Jewish people for Jewish causes, State of Israel, and so on. So as a congregational rabbi and a host of a podcast and radio show, I can tell you that Jews tend to be extraordinarily philanthropic, depending on the generations. It seems to be diminishing over time, as you noted earlier. And that's why there are so many Jewish names on hospitals, universities, symphonies, and so on, museums. Museums, but not necessarily Jewish causes in the same way. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, I think it's very clear by the recent literature that many, many more Jewish giving goes to non-Jewish causes. And that's okay. I'm not saying that if somebody wants to save whales, they shouldn't do it with the charitable remains of their estate. It's not their estate that we're after. We're after the what's in the estate for charity purposes. And so consequently, the promise is really designed not only to do your estate planning with what you're leaving charitably, but to talk to your children, your family, your grandchildren about your commitment for the Jewish future, not just for the Jewish today and for Israel. And so that's what we try to do, and that's what we try to measure without interfering in the planning process, what people are doing that have actually signed the Jewish Future Promise. And we do that, and we survey them, and we've had excellent results so far, and we continue to build. July was a record month for us. August beat July in terms of numbers of signatures, and so we're we're doing very, very well. It took a while in the beginning, but now we're really getting some good statistical data.
Tell us, it's not just the numbers of people. There are some extraordinary names on this list. Tell us about some of the people involved who have made this Jewish Future promise.
Well, we have some very, very significant foundations, such as the Leon Cooperman's Foundation, Bernie Marcus's Foundation, the late Bernie Marcus.
That was Home Depot, the founder of that. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, those people have signed, and that's very significant money. And the rest of, we're not interested only in wealthy people with foundations. We're interested in the mass market of Jews and how they can continue to support after they're gone, and how they can convince and influence their progeny, their children, their grandchildren, and their friends about what their commitments are. That's the real purpose of it, to be able to have a significant group. Present literature only indicates that 38% of Jews belong to synagogues, for example. Very few go to Jewish day schools, their children or their grandchildren. And so while others work on some of that stuff to promote it and do it and give money to it, what's going to happen after those people are gone? So that's really our objective. And so we really measure two things, I think, most importantly. The first is, have you spoken to your family about the promise? And right now, 46.3% have indicated that they are doing that. 27.5% have already taken concrete steps to actualize the promise, which means they're doing something in their wills or in donor-advised funds, things of that kind. And we have some other situations, like 42% have told their friends about the promise. So we're starting to get a significant amount of numbers that, if you want to translate it into dollars, you probably can. But that's not really the issue so much as it is to remove any doubt that there will still be people who remember the old days of supporting Jewish causes. And that has to continue generation to generation.
Now, we are looking at the largest transfer of wealth probably in Jewish history, right? From one generation to another now, first to the kind of the builders and then the baby boomers. These are large numbers we're talking about. And so this is important. I want to note just a couple of the other names that show up on your website, mm-hmm. Moti Rosenfeld, Alan Dershowitz, some past guests of Two Jewish, I should note, Noah Tishby.
Correct.
As well as mega donors like Harold Greenspoon and the late Bernie Marcus.
Sure.
There's some really remarkable people here. There's no cost to doing this, right?
No cost. Well, the only cost is
50% of your estate. But yeah.
Right. No, I think it's a 501c3. We've been offered money, believe it or not, which is strange. We don't take any money. I'm the sole funder for the overhead that is involved in doing this. And about 50% of our expense goes to marketing it, and about 50% goes to payroll. Consequently, we have 5 full-time workers. We have a marketing firm. And I turned down people who were so willing to give me a gift because I want to prove that we can do something with my assets and really as a legacy gift for me, because essentially my children know that what I'm paying to do the Jewish Future Promise is really, I have 3 children, so they're really contributing 1/3, 1/3, and 1/3 of the cost.
Very nice of them to do so. You know, here in Tucson, when the Jewish Community Foundation started, they had an endowment book of life. You just signed saying mm-hmm. you were committing to giving some of your estate. You didn't have to specify yet. You didn't have to fill out the paperwork and so on. That was great. I want to talk about a difficult question. Foundations tend to control the funds and disperse some of the income from their funds to the institutions, but they often are, even if they're Jewish foundations, they direct it to all kinds of other causes. Is there any data as to how much Jewish community foundations actually give to Jewish causes these days?
Well, historically, the large foundations in some recent Pew studies indicated that only about 11% of their gifts were going Jewishly. But at the end of the day, I think there are certain Jewish foundations that have done more than that, But basically, I believe it's gone up a little bit since October 7th, strangely enough. I think Wertheim's book indicates about $13 billion is spent now in the Jewish world from North America to for Jewish causes in Israel since the October 7th situation. That's a lot of money and a lot more than what it was prior to that. But I don't think that we can survive effectively if we have to go and do things on a crisis basis. I was on the Red Cross board for many years, for 7 years, when Elizabeth Dole was the president of the Red Cross. We used to wait for a tornado in order to be able to raise money, or a hurricane.
Right.
And basically, I don't think it's appropriate for us to be waiting for the crisis to be able to make commitments to the Jewish people. I think we have to make that commitment to say, look, no one's going to support us except us. We're not asking Christians to donate money to Jewish causes, even though many evangelical Christians do support Israel in a variety of ways, and we accept it, and it's nice, but we can't depend on non-Jews, especially because if we have the largesse to be able to give away money, we should take care of, as Maimonides said, I can't remember the exact quote was, you give to your family first, then you give to the Jewish people second, and if there's anything left, you give it to everybody else. That's my
right. He may not neely meely. If we don't do it for ourselves, who's going to do it for us?
Well, I think Hillel, somebody said that once.
Hillel said it, I promise.
That's right. He said everything. I get a big kick. Every Sunday morning, I get the data for the week. Adara, my president, sends me the data. And every Sunday morning, I've been watching the numbers go up. And I know that I can't depend on everybody from a foundation. I have to depend also on small givers. And small givers, it doesn't make any difference to me whether you're leaving $10 to charity or $10 million. I think it's the idea that your children, your family, your grandchildren know that they have to stand up for the Jewish causes and obviously support Israel. Those are two things that I've watched in the course of my lifetime. I'll be 88 years old in November.
Kinohora, we say, Bizahudit and Sansik.
It wasn't until in my 30s that I represented myself to be part of the Jewish community that I could do some things. In the latter part of my life, I was fortunate enough to be able to do what I do. And I'm involved in many, many different things besides the Jewish Future Promise. I talk to a lot of people in the Jewish world and to Israel. And it gives me such a lot of nachas to watch the numbers go up every week.
Tell us a little bit about how ethical wills are connected here. I always found that subject kind of fascinating.
Yeah, we do some stuff with that. If people want our help, we provide them with the information if they want that. We send out a monthly newsletter, which about 35% of the people read, and we get inquiries about help with that, and we supply some of that situation. But really, really the idea is to have a conversation and at Shabbat, at Passover, at Rosh Hashanah, at Yom Kippur, at Sukkot, at all the holidays and whatever. And I think the common literature says that some of the battle is being lost, and we cannot afford, we are too small. We're 15 million people in a world of 8 billion. And building Jewish pride, look what we accomplish. I mean, it's amazing. And we need our young people and our friends to understand how important it is that we support ourselves.
Mike, I have to add a personal note as an AE Pi and a former chapter advisor. Apparently, we share that connection as well.
Well, AE Pi, you know, I've run for 12 years a leadership program at AE Pi. My hypothesis is people who lead in the fraternity will lead in life. And we run a 3-day conference every year. We have 900 graduates that we track what they're doing in life. Some are rabbis, some are teachers. Some scientists, some really run companies, over. And so we now have an 11-year history, and the 12th conference goes on in January.
I should note that it is the only still Jewishly affiliated fraternity in America. Mike, tell us how people can get involved with Jewish Future Promise, where they go, and how they start this process.
Well, if they read the material in the website, they can sign the process. It's a moral obligation. It is not a legal obligation. It's a moral obligation. There are instructions as to what to do, and if they have questions, they send an email in to us, and we have people there that will either direct them or actually help them directly in what they're doing in their planning process. Lots of people that sign already have donor advised funds, already have talked to financial advisors, whatever. Of course, the foundations do that without our help. We don't need that. But the end result is that it's making people aware of the problem that becomes the predominant scenario. It's basically saying everybody can help. It doesn't make any difference if you're a small donor or a large donor. That direct your donorship to supporting Israel and the Jewish people in one way or another. We don't tell them actually where to give, although one family, Bernie Marcus and I had a long conversation years ago when I started saying, well, you got to tell them where to give. I said, I want them to pick their own. There's so many ways that they can help the Jewish people. Even one-to-one, you can help a Jewish person.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mike. Really appreciate it. The organization has a terrific website, jewishfuturepromise.org, O-R-G, just like it sounds. Thank you so much.
Okay, Rabbi Sam, thank you for the time.
And Shana Tova, a good new year and a healthy one. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Two Jewish. Our guest will be Professor Barry Strauss, author of the terrific new book, Jews versus Rome. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha for the Jewish High Holy Days coming up 2 weeks from tomorrow night, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org for the schedule and to register. Also join us at Beit Simcha every Friday night. Services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. Torah services, Torah reading, and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. And join us for Slichot this coming Saturday night. What does it take to change a Kabbalistic exploration? Our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes for the upcoming High Holy Days, 2 weeks away now. It's B'Sefer Chaim. Write us in the Book of Life, Peace, and Blessing in the coming new year of 5786. This version was performed on Prairie Home Companion, of all places, by Rich Dworsky and Richard Crean. This is the melody we use at Beit Simcha, by the way. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and of peace.
בספר חיים ברכה ושלום ופרנסה טובה. נזכר וניכתב לפניך.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.